Hey everyone, Steve Cooper, TheConservativeMonster.com. Today we have Jeff Nyquist on the radio show, and his website is JrNyquist.com, StrategicCrisis.com. This is Mr. Nyquist's third interview with the Conservative Monster. I really appreciate it. And he's a political analyst, and I've been following his work for the past 8 years. So, Jeff, how are you? How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm hanging in there. You know, I'm curious to hear your opinion on the Occupy Wall Street. You know, what's your opinion on what's going on here? Is this the start of something big or what?
Yeah, well, it's not totally unexpected. It seems that the revolutionary left needs to make its move while President Obama is still in the White House. I was told by communist activists 30 years ago that their plan was to elect a stealth communist president when at a time of economic crisis, when there was another Great Depression, and to then make a revolution from within, where the president would change the political system to socialism and run, you know, nationalize all businesses and run it like the post office, because people would lose faith in capitalism in a depression, that they could be made to turn against the system that had failed them. And this is also, you'll find this also in defector literature. Jan Sena wrote about this in his memoirs, We Will Bury You. He wrote that the long-range strategy for the United States included the election of a transitional progressive president at a time of economic crisis, so that the people would turn against capitalism and this progressive president would change the system. But this was even within Soviet planning, going back into the 1960s. So this has been a long-standing goal of the communists, to blame Wall Street, blame capitalism, get people to turn against the system. And this protest against Wall Street is an anti-capitalist protest. It's a call for a socialist revolution. And of course, they have their man in the White House. If he were to have the public support that he would want, is what he would need to basically push capitalism out of the way.
Now, I have this theory. Everyone says, oh, the left is upset with President Obama. The left is upset with President Obama. But my theory is they're upset that he hasn't declared a dictatorship yet. Is that what do you think about that?
Well, I think that the left has to, the certain elements on the far left have to speak out against Obama, because that makes Obama appear to be a centrist.
True. Excellent point.
It's very important for the far left to, you know, the Communist Party USA endorsed Obama for president, but that's not particularly helpful for the president, for all these leftists to say, oh, we love him and he's our guy and he's going to make the revolution for us. They can't really say that. That can't be part of their program. So if they're really clever, they're gonna say, no, he's not our guy. We're against him. We hate what he's doing. He's a shill. He's a capitalist stooge. This basically is tactics. This is maneuvering. This is the kind of thing the left does. The president himself was part of this milieu, you know, 30 years ago. He was a communist when he was in college. He was part of the Young Socialist Scholars. If you read, it's been documented in Stanley Kurtz's book, Radical in Chief, Barack Obama and the Untold Story of American Socialism. I mean, it's just very well documented what Obama was into. And these are the same kind of groups, you know, ACORN and UNO and these other groups, whether they're Latin or black or just plain left. They're all leftist groups that are agitating for a socialist revolution in the United States. And they will use any occasion. Of course, you know, the most fundamental freedom we have is the freedom to buy and sell. It's even more fundamental than the right to free speech. If you take away people's freedom to buy and sell and invest and use their own money the way they see fit, you take away the whole productivity of the American system, and you permanently crash the economy, then you claim that capitalism has failed and you have to take over with your socialist dictatorship. I mean, that's sort of the game. The secret about socialism or communism is that its greatest power is that it appeals to the secret power lust of certain people. And these people join the movement in the hopes of having power and making a revolution and getting total control over everything. And of course, they hide it under all this, oh, we're going to help the poor and we're going to help these people. No, it's all for, they're all out for power. Because why do you want to take away everyone's freedom and take power yourself? That's just power loss. And that's really what it's all about. It's always been about that, whatever they say to the contrary.
Well, that's what I try to tell people that believe the bunk, is that they're brainwashed and they're listening to a bunch of lies, and that communism is based on lies, deception, and it's a criminal conspiracy. Now, so you're saying, like, this is my theory too, is that, and I've heard other people mention it, but not in the media, of course. So the goal here is civil unrest, so that maybe he can get more power. Is that what you think?
Well, the civil unrest is aimed at Wall Street, and it's important to remember that it's the free enterprise system that is the core of America's strength and the key to America's military strength and the key to the prosperity of the middle class. If you take away people's money and prosperity, and they can only eat if they cooperate with the government, that is the basis of a socialist totalitarian state. That's what they did in the Soviet Union. You don't go along with the state, you don't get a ration card, you don't get to eat. And so the government, if the government can control the economy, can control the behavior of everybody. And it's just a basic socialist principle in flipping the system. If you have a free country, it's only free if you have the freedom to buy and sell. If you don't, then the government owns anything and everything and runs everything and hires everybody and pays everybody and feeds everybody, and then it's not free. If you only have one employer in an entire country, it's not a free country.
Right. Well, I wrote a little editorial the other day, and I find it interesting that 9/11, on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, you think back, capitalism was attacked on 9/11, and now we have a bunch of radical left-wing Marxist and anarchists protesting at Wall Street. So once again, capitalism is the target, and I try to tie it into people that read my site that, you know, the attacks on 9/11 is a war against capitalism. And so is this, what you're seeing today. It's a constant struggle to defeat capitalism. Do you see that link that I'm trying to make to my readers?
My thinking about 9/11 is that there is evidence and there's testimony, although it's not proven, that the same communist networks of the Soviet Union were behind 9/11. That Alexander Litvinenko, famously the former FSB KGB officer who was poisoned with polonium in London in 2006, publicly stated 16 months before his death that Vladimir Putin and the KGB were behind 9/11 and all the terrorism in Al Qaeda.
Right.
He knew that the current head of Al Qaeda is Ayman al-Zawahiri. He was responsible for maintaining Ayman al-Zawahiri's security in the Russian Federation when he was there in 96, being trained by the FSB. He was there to make sure that the Interior Ministry police didn't accidentally stumble upon him and arrest him and cause an exposure of his status as an agent of the Russian Federation. Litvinenko said that Ayman al-Zawahiri was a long-time agent of the KGB, as well as other members of Al-Qaeda, that the terrorism has been a project, including Islamic and Arab terrorism, has been a project of the KGB. I mean, it was, Mike Pacepa made the statement in a column more than a decade ago that airline hijacking was invented by a KGB general in Moscow. At least this KGB general claims credit for it. So there's also my friends in the Czech Republic and former communist Czechoslovakia have claimed to me testimony from a former captain of the BIS, the Czech Intelligence Service, that Mohammed Atta was trained at a terrorist training camp in former communist Czechoslovakia in 1987.
Right. I remember you publishing that information. And, you know, I try to do the best along with all the information that you put out to help spread the word that, you know, this is not only a Muslim phenomenon we're seeing here, but it's also it's the tie to Moscow and didn't even the Chinese, they released, the Chinese military mentioned something in a book about Bin Laden flying planes into the World Trade Center before, this was before the attacks on 9/11. Do you remember hearing that?
I remember hearing something. I don't remember if it was that exactly. I mean, there's. I know that the president of China at the time, Jiang Zemin, when 9/11 happened, they say that he watched the footage of the towers collapsing and the planes hitting the buildings over and over again for hours on end. He was just riveted by it.
Wow.
And to understand why they were so riveted by it, it's important to know that this strategy. Look, what is Russia and China doing jointly? They've been trying to collapse the dollar. Of course, ironically, their plan, like many of their economic plans, has backfired, and the euro is collapsing instead. The unit of currency that they were hoping to replace the dollar with is collapsing. So it's they've had a lot of setbacks in their strategies and a lot of problems, and you know, proving that the KGB was involved in 9/11 is a very difficult thing to do. I mean, you got to go to Muhammad Ali's trips to Prague, Czechoslovakia. You've got the Czech services tried to throw us off the tail thing. He was meeting with one of Saddam Hussein's representatives there. But there's a mystery there that isn't easy to investigate because there are so many East agents, so many agents of the former Soviet bloc and hidden structures engaged in active disinformation warfare and confusion. You know, this whole 9/11 attack, you could find a description of it in the works of Viktor Suvorov in a book called Spetsnaz. And in that book, he describes something called Gray Terror, in which the West is attacked by a terrorist group that has no apparent connection to the Soviet Union or Russia. And that this Great Terror is meant to distract the Western security services, intelligence services, and police away from the main threat of communism to this fake threat that essentially diverts them and serves as a kind of decoy, a strategic decoy, as it will, the existence of an enemy that's sort of a fabrication. And this is in Soviet strategy. It's discussed by Suvorov in his work, and Great Terror is, by the way, the precursor to Red Terror, which is an open attack, open warfare against the West by the Soviet bloc. And if people think the Soviet Union has collapsed, it's very interesting. You know, the president of Ukraine, a week ago Friday on Ukrainian television, the former president of Ukraine, who was a Soviet official, Leonid Kravchuk, made an astonishing statement on Ukrainian television.
What was that?
That Putin, he said Putin and Medvedev are not the real rulers in Russia. They're not the ones with power. He said that a step above them is a secret group whose names are not given out, who actually rule and make policy and decide the strategy in Russia. And he used the word, he compared it to the way Gaddafi was running Libya. Gaddafi was actually had a group of strategists, a Politburo that was above him, telling him what to do. And so he said it's like that in Russia. So Russia is run by a secret Politburo. This matches up with the warnings of Anatoly Golitsyn, Jan Sena, and others who said that there was a long-range Moscow strategy to collapse communism, to get the West to go to sleep and to launch a giant peace offensive, to change the balance of power, to collapse the dollar and destroy capitalism, and make a revolution in the Western countries, and then, if necessary, use nuclear weapons to finish the job. This is the kind of... if you look closely at current events and the Russian hand and the policies of Russia and China carefully, you'll see they're following this plan. They're still following it. It's still apparent. They're not having success on all fronts. They've had a lot of setbacks, but they're still following it, and they're determined. And they've used the acceptance of the collapse of communism to infiltrate our financial institutions, to infiltrate our government. We have more communist infiltration and penetration and subversion today than at any other time in the history of the West, since communism existed. And yet, because we believe communism has collapsed, we have no mechanism anymore for coping with its subversion and infiltration.
Wow, great point. Okay, so Jeff, you know what I wanted to mention too was we talked about this through email. The Norway attacks. Anders Breivik, okay, there was an article released in the Russian media stating that his code name was Viking, his KGB code name was Viking, and that he was trained in Belarus. And so what's your thoughts on this? And plus, it's interesting that there was a lot of propaganda released that he was a Christian, a right-winger, but this is report was stating that he was trained by Russian intelligence. What do you think about this?
Well, in Anders' memoir, or in Anders' manifesto, he praises Vladimir Putin and the Russian state as being the model for Europe. And I think I've mentioned this to you before, Steve, either on the air or off the air before. We have to understand how Russian strategy is changing. Russia is moving heavily to influence and infiltrate the right in Europe and in the United States.
Right.
Both with the... It's very important to understand this, that they're incredibly flexible, that people can be on the right and be completely following Russian disinformation and not realize it. Like, for example, the 9/11 Truther movement.
Yeah.
9/11 Truther movement, if you look at it carefully, is supported by the Russian services and Russian disinformation campaigns. You find this kind of information in sources that regularly pass Moscow's disinformation, both today and 40 years ago. But it's to capture the right in Europe. There is a writer in Europe named Guillaume Fillet. He's a Frenchman. He wrote a book called something Futurism.
All right, don't worry about it.
The name of the book.
It's okay.
Guillaume Fillet's work, he goes to Moscow quite a bit, and the idea of the work is that Moscow forms this gigantic Trans-Siberian possibility for Europe, that there could be a new Roman Empire with Russia as its protector, and it could be from Brest in France to Vladivostok in Siberia all the way in the Pacific, and include all the European countries. And Fillet even makes the statement that France should no longer be called France, it should be called Gaul, and that our real nationality is we're white European. And he's very anti-Islamist in saying, look, the non-Europeans need to be out of Europe, Europe for the Europeans, and the Russians are the people who understand how to fight Islam. And Anders is in this sort of grouping where you have both anti-Islamic and neo-Nazi and far-right racialistic kind of grouping, and Russia is supporting a kind of European racism, a pan-European racism with Russia at the head of it, and to energize the far right in Europe on Russian side.
Interesting.
This is a very unique strategy. These groups, CA, by the way, is somewhat anti-American if you read his work. Archaeofuturism is the name of his book. Just came out, I believe, last year. It was published in England, and I got a hold of a copy of it. It's really worth following this stuff because this philosophy is only slightly different from that proposed by Alexander Dugin, who's the chief ideologist behind this Eurasianism that Putin is putting forward. Dugin is a very he's the son, I believe, of a Soviet general, a GRU general, I think, and he's been involved in sort of helping to formulate new ideology for the new union. And of course they know they can't go back to communism overtly because, you know, even though they haven't buried Lenin and the top leaders are communists, I mean Yevgeny Primakov, who probably is one of the top leaders, has said, you know, I'm still a communist, they can't really govern Russia that way and they can't really take over countries that way because communism, wherever it has been tried, is not believed in by hardly anybody.
Well, you know that
come up with a new ideology.
Right.
Yeah, lots of people believe in communism. I'd say there's a good 10-20% of the population, given the mood of the moment, who happen to like big on Marx. You know, they kind of like it. They think capitalism has failed, or capitalism is, yeah, it's all about greed, you know, and all those greedy Wall Street people, they've ruined the economy. These people are such idiots, they don't even know that they'd be living in some saw a tavern somewhere filled with Wall Street.
Right. And I'm sure another 25% are open to communism. I believe that's another theory I have, is that they're trying to get the people, wearing them down, into accepting any type of more government control, because basically, you know, the economy will be shattered so much and the middle class will be shattered so much, they'll accept any help that they can get from the government. And so basically, that's why the word, you know, that's my theory too. Another, the communism and socialism is never mentioned in the media, and it's because people, they don't want people to be able to identify it or know what it is when it comes. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, 30 years ago, I had this conversation with Eric Shearer, who was at that time helping to organize the movement for democratic economic democracy that Jane Fonda's husband, Tom Hayden, was organizing at the time. Eric Shearer was working for Hayden. I think he helped write Hayden's book. I think the book was called Economic Democracy. This is 30 years ago. They came to my campus at UC Irvine when I was a senior in 1981 to give a talk, and I listened to the talk, and I thought, well, this economic democracy sounds like communism. So I there weren't very many people attending the meeting, so I went up to Shearer afterwards, and Derek Shearer, I believe, was later appointed as ambassador to Finland by President Clinton. I asked Shearer, I said, well, what's the difference between economic democracy and communism? And he looked at me kind of startled, and he looked at who I was with. I had a couple of friends that I played chess with who were you know, communists, and they're the ones that dragged me to this meeting. And he looked at me and he says, well, I probably shouldn't say this, but there is no difference between economic democracy and communism. And he explained to me that we can't use the C word, communism, because the American people are conditioned to have a negative reaction to communism. And we can't use the S word, socialism, for the same reason. So we have to invent other language to talk about communism without using the word communism. And that's why they coined the term economic democracy. I haven't heard that term lately, but now they like more generalized terms like fairness and fair play and economic justice and so on.
Right.
But it all has the same meaning. They want to be able to advance communism without people realizing what it is.
Right.
And basically the issue boils down to, as I said, look, everybody just needs to think about this for a minute. Economic freedom. If the government can tell you what to buy and sell and tell you you can't buy or sell, your freedom of speech is worthless. Your other freedoms are completely worthless, because now you're a complete slave economically to the government, to the state. Because if you don't have the freedom to buy and sell, that means the state dictates all your economic activity, your job, your employment, how much you're paid, how much you're fed, what you do, and besides the fact that an economy organized in that way is an economy of pauperization, where everybody stands in long line for very little food, or very poor food and staples, and there's very little building or construction going on, and the economy is completely stagnant. But the leaders are in absolute total control.
Well, plus you have so many of these kids, they're graduating college, they have a master's degree, and there's no jobs for them. So they're already brainwashed to start a revolution, because they're in the belief that they will be part of the elite if they do. It's just total nonsense. They're not going to be part of the elite. They're going to wind up in a mass grave somewhere.
Well, some of them might be part of the elite if their revolution succeeds, but yeah, their life won't be as good as if they'd stayed with capitalism, even though they hate the capitalist system. They're just too dumb to know it. You know, the problem with college education today is that so much of the left and so much Marxism is injected in. A lot of people would object to this, but I've been in the university system, and they're taught Marxism without the label. And people who aren't really politically aware and haven't studied communism, well, they wouldn't even know a communist if you did them.
Right.
If a communist bit them. So it's they don't really understand what kind of propaganda, what kind of nonsense they've been given. They don't really fully understand it. And of course, people are easily misled in areas where they do not have any direct knowledge themselves.
You know, you mentioned the 9/11 truthers, and you know, I'm glad that you mentioned the Russian intelligence link to that propaganda movement, because it's something I've always mentioned on my website, and you know, really, there's very few people that have come out and said you know, or linked them to the Marxist movement. And so, what's your opinion on this, like this whole Ron Paul thing? Like everyone, you know, it's like I believe he just infiltrated the Republican Party, and it's like they're watering down what conservatism is.
Well, Ron Paul is a libertarian. He's not really conservative.
Right, but that's the lie that they keep telling. He's a staunch conservative. You know, that's, they just repeat the lie over and over again, you know?
He's a very ideological libertarian. And the thing is that libertarianism is about absolute freedom. And yes, you know, I believe in economic liberty, and I believe that a lot of the things that Ron Paul says about the economy and about the abuses of government are true, and this is where his appeal comes from.
Right.
But the man does not live by bread alone. It isn't only economic freedom, everything and forever. The fact of the matter is the country is in a struggle, a long-term war. The Cold War never ended, and Russia and China are dangerous enemies of the United States. We've made enormous mistakes. Capitalism has been lured into believing that China's its economic trading partner and is about to find out what a horrible mistake that's been. And Russia, of course, as everybody has found out in the last decade, is completely treacherous and untrustworthy as a partner, economic or political. And we have to be just wary of this mafia state that is the Russian Federation.
Right.
So, when Ron Paul talks about American involvement overseas being bad and calling everybody home, yeah, I have questions about our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was not gung-ho for that. I thought that there was some possible misjudgments there because, you know, the United States does not have unlimited resources and manpower to commit to conflicts in these backwater countries. But all that being said, the United States security umbrella around the world is what maintains the global market and the stability of all these countries and keeps the world, keeps the goods and services flowing in the world and the international division of labor. It allows the globe as a whole to continue to prosper economically. And you can see that even with the problems of the last decade, the global economy is faltering, even with all that. We need more freedom, more stability in the international markets in order to get things going again. And unfortunately, it's the communists that are trying to destabilize the international currency and destroy America's security hegemony, because that security hegemony that the United States has over the countries that want to trade and want to participate in the global market is what allows everything to work. You remove that and you have total chaos, not only politically and militarily, you know, like we had in 1939 when Hitler unleashed his war on Europe and the Japanese were invading China. We could have a similar kind of thing happen today where trade shuts down and countries start warring and revolutions break out. And of course, you talk about it, if you think economic times are hard now, you ought to see what it'd be like then.
Right. So what's your vision of the future here as far as Putin and Europe? I was mentioned to you over email that I my prediction or feeling is that Russia will take them over without even firing a shot. Can you see that? Is that possible?
I don't think so. I mean, Europe is very weak and poorly armed. And Russia is arming, and they are aware of it. In Scandinavia and the Baltic states, they've been crying, sounding an alarm. You know, the Finnish defense ministry put out a report not too long ago talking about the Russian buildup in the north. You know, the Baltic states have had controversy about how to fix this to the rest of NATO. But the key events that are happening now are the meltdown of the euro. Right now, the story, you probably heard it, is the Germans are printing Deutschmarks now.
Right.
And that means that the Germans abandoned the euro and returned to the Deutschmark.
Mm-hmm.
The eurozone is dead.
Right.
You know, the European Union is dead. The whole economic thing is dead. I mean, after all, these small countries decided to give full retirement pensions to 37 or 38-year-olds, you know, civil servants. on the German dime, you know. I mean, basically, they bankrupted themselves giving these plus pensions, I mean, the same way they did in Iceland, the same way we're doing here. And, of course, they're having revolutions there, and they expect the Germans to pay.
Well,
the Germans don't want to bail out Portugal, Spain, Italy, and Greece.
Right.
And they're going to back away from it, and it's too much of a burden for them. And so there are some people are predicting that the euro is going to collapse in the next 3 weeks, that Germany is going to abandon the euro and these Deutschmarks. I mean, we don't know. If Germany prints Deutschmarks, it doesn't mean they're going to use them, but it's like a loaded gun to the rest of Europe, that's saying, you know, it can't be all on us.
Well, you know, I wasn't talking about an actual invasion. I was talking about actually, like, controlling Europe, basically through the EU, and you know, between the euro collapse and also Russia controls the oil and the gas.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They can hold that over their head. Go ahead.
It is through chaos unleashed in Europe.
Right.
That the Germans, I mean, that the Russians are hoping to get control, and they're hoping to get control through a scissor strategy in which the European left, that's influenced by Moscow, and
right.
the far right,
uh-huh.
influenced by Moscow,
right.
into a political, you know, and what happens in Europe typically when the economy goes south and there's collapse, you have an erosion of the center.
Right.
Pretty typical in European, most European countries' politics. There's erosion of the center that allows the right and the left to form, you know, that's what National Socialism was, the unification of the far right and the far left in Weimar Germany.
Right.
Get the same kind of formula here for Europe. It seems that the Red-Brown Alliance is the card that the Moscow wants to play in Europe to dominate European politics to the far right and the left. And if they can achieve that in key countries, especially in Germany, France, and Austria, they can then fragment NATO, get those countries to leave, get Germany to leave NATO.
Right.
A new kind of security infrastructure. If you listen to President Putin in Russia, he has made these references constantly that what we want is a new security architecture for Europe.
Yes.
And he uses the word security architecture. And what that is a code word for, we want NATO. We want NATO to be gone. We want a new kind of organization in NATO's place. We want in an organization that the Americans are not in, that is a Russian-dominated security organization, and that's basically what Russia wants to do. If Russia can get the United States out of Europe, not only can Russia economically dominate Europe, but it can also, through intimidation and political means, and through its mafia information on different politicians in Europe, it can manipulate European countries. I mean, Vladimir Bukovsky made the statement that many European nations are so heavily influenced by Russian penetration through organized crime and through the left that they are virtually, you know, beholden to Moscow on many issues. And if this can be extended and consolidated in an actual formal security alliance or security structure, perhaps this Eurasian, an extension of this Eurasian Union that Putin is now proposing, which, of course, he says is only to bring the former Soviet republics and the near abroad back into union with Russia. But to realize this can be extended to all of Europe and that there's a political movement in Europe to make this happen is important. And what you probably may see in Europe is a kind of red-brown alliance to make a Eurasian empire out of the whole of Europe connected with Russia.
So I believe we mentioned this.
Plan.
Right. We spoke about this, I think, once before over email. I said, I asked you, do you think that the Norway attacks was a message to Europe, basically that the bear is back and you better not try and cut us out from our gas monopoly? What's your opinion on that?
Well, yeah, Norway is the biggest gas producer outside of Russia, and it definitely was an attack on a gas producer. But I think that the ethnic motive of the attack, what Anders did is bring attention to the fact that Russia is this anti-Islamic power that's been fighting Islam in Chechnya, ostensibly, and that all Europeans should unite against political correctness, and that we need a tougher neo-fascist kind of system in Europe.
Interesting.
So that he's sort of providing the brown shirts solution to the era of the problem.
Right.
And this is an advertisement for what, people like Yuyami Fiye have talked about this kind of terrorism erupting in Europe, and of course here it is. Some of these people believe this is the future of Europe, that the European youth are going to rise up.
Right.
And say, we don't want to be
Muslim.
We don't want to be Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
We need the Europe to the Europeans. We need to fight this. You've seen it, of course, the turn in Holland and the turn in Germany, and Denmark, of course, that has become very anti-Muslim or becoming anti-Muslim and are realizing that, Chancellor of Germany, she made a statement here. It was last year where he said that Muslims aren't integrating; they're not becoming German. They're maintaining their distinct ethnic identity as Arabs or Turks or Muslims, and so it's not working. Well, this admission that political correctness and multiculturalism doesn't work is decisive for European politics. And the more this gains momentum in Europe, the more Europe becomes susceptible. See, the Russians have looked at the future trends of Europe and realized that inevitably Europeans are going to become more race conscious, and they're going to move against the Muslims. There's going to be this civil war in Europe between the Europeans and the Muslims. And that civil war, if Russia positions itself properly to take advantage of this in European politics and become sort of the hero.
Right.
This is where you get this dispute between, you got Turkey rising and Turkey threatening Greece and Cyprus over the gas and oil that's been found in the Eastern Mediterranean, and they're threatening Israel as well. This kind of positioning, supposedly the Russians sent two attack submarines to Cyprus to defend the Greeks. This allows Russia to move into Europe as the kind of protector and defender and to gain popularity and prestige in Europe in a way that they haven't been able to do in the last 100 years.
It's brilliant. It makes sense. And, it's right up the alley of the KGB, and they love to manipulate the masses, through mass, techniques like this. It's really brilliant. I mean, you have to hand it to them. They're just... they're on top of everything on every different angle, and nobody ever comes out with it. You're the only one I hear ever talk about it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, they make a lot of mistakes. They screwed up their plan to unite Germany and get it under a leftist government in 1989. They screwed that up, and although they maintain their agent networks in Eastern Europe, and a lot of the heads of state and prime ministers of these East European countries are still under their control and were agents of this, have admitted as being agents of the Communist Secret Police in Soviet times. It still has been very difficult for them to make their strategy go.
Well,
and so they've had to be very creative, especially in recent years, and with the creation of Eurasianism and the fostering of these right wing movements in Europe. This is their new turn, their new way to flip the situation to their advantage.
Well, I wanted to ask you another question. I'll let you go. I really appreciate you coming on the Conservative Monster Radio Show. I'm speaking with Jeff Nyquist. You go to his website, jrnyquist.com and strategiccrisis.com. I've been, following his work for many years and really just, you won't find anyone like him on the internet. It's really brilliant work, Jeff. And also, not only to tell you is... okay, we were talking about NATO earlier, and we all know that the Russians would love to disband NATO and drag Europe away. Back in 2001, we flashed back to what we were talking about earlier, the possible link between Russia and 9/11, which I believe 100%, okay? I believe Iran perpetrated for them, that's my opinion, and the nuclear plant was a little thank you gift for them. But back in 2001, George Bush wanted the Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. And he gave a speech, I believe it was in Georgia, might have been Georgia, back in May 2001. And you know, mysteriously, 3 months later in Pravda, there's you know, a warning for people to withdraw money from the United States, any type of American you know, investments that they have, because an attack was coming on the financial system. So do you believe that Bush wanting Georgia and Ukraine to join NATO was the final straw for Putin? Putin said, pulled the trigger and said, let's do it on 9/11?
Well, 9/11, of course, is the birthday of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet secret police.
Right.
So it has a sort of symbolism, but
what was his name? Nikita Khrushchev died on 9/11 also in 1971 or 2. That was the date that Nikita Khrushchev died also.
Huh. Interesting. I didn't know that. This is interesting. I think that if you look at the Soviet strategy and the moves of the Russian Federation and the secret leadership of Russia since 1991, you'll see they've been moving in the direction of a 9/11 style attack. That Al Qaeda was being prepared in the 1990s for this attack.
Right.
This attack was talked about much earlier than this proposed. The Russians have such a strong agent network in Ukraine. They were able to. You know how they stopped the Ukraine entering NATO was that the President Kuchma of Ukraine was maligned as being behind the murder of a Georgian Ukrainian journalist named Gengadze.
Wow.
Who is, of course, and it depends on who you talk to, but it looks like the Russians tried to frame Kuchma for this. It was a KGB type bodyguard who released tapes, supposedly, that indicated Kuchma didn't like the journalist. Of course, now this site that Gengadze was working on, my friends in Ukraine tell me that this was a site that the FSB had set up in Russia, because the FSB sets up all kinds of, you know, Ukrainian patriotic type situations. And so the whole deal was, if Kuchma could be made to look like a criminal, a dictator and a criminal and a murderer, then, of course, NATO would back away from Ukraine, which is what happened. Because Kuchma, a lot of these Ukrainian leaders that had a Soviet past, you know, Ukrainian hatred of what the Soviet Union did to Ukrainians during the Ukraine famine is extraordinary. I mean, they killed between 11 and 18 million Ukrainians. Stalin did, and the Soviet system did, and a lot of Ukrainians, even Communist Party members, could never forgive them for that. And once they would have a chance at some kind of independence, they would play it. And this is what it appears that Leonid Kravchuk did, is what Kuchma did. They were communist officials who pulled Moscow into thinking that they were playing the game, but in every chance they got, they asserted a kind of subversive independence for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
When Moscow started striking back. And this, you will remember, Ukraine then had the poisoning of the presidential candidate, Viktor Yushchenko.
Right.
Tried to frame it so that Yanukovych, the other candidate, would be blamed. But in reality, it was Moscow's agents, who were members of the Ukrainian intelligence service who had poisoned Yushchenko. They fled to Moscow, at least two of them fled to Moscow, where they work for the FSB at high levels today. So, and Moscow won't extradite them because they're their own guys.
Yeah.
So that Ukraine has fought this struggle to maintain its independence, and Yanukovych has fooled the Russians again. But what Viktor Zubov said about it is that you can fool the Russians once, but you can't fool them twice. In other words, the Russians understand what game Yanukovych is playing now. And Yanukovych and Yushchenko are kind of conspiring together, the former president and the present president of Ukraine. And it's the same thing with Georgia. Georgia got its independence, and the Russians tried to get it back by invading it and testing in 1988. And you know what the significance of the 8/8 attack is within Russian national right-wing national brown red-brown nationalist circles? You know what the 8/8 stands for?
No.
the HH of Heil Hitler. H is the eighth letter of the alphabet.
Wow.
This has been going around on the Russian internet, HH, you know. I mean, this is the kind of symbolism, this is the kind of, you know, red-brown kind of coordinating that goes on, and to prevent those countries from joining NATO is an important part of Russia's strategy.
Hmm.
And of course, to break up NATO now by having Turkey at odds with the rest of the NATO alliance, and having you know, having this economic thing breaking up the Eurozone and the European Union, causing conflicts between Germany and these other countries, is a key to see if they can do it, and to have the United States so economically weakened that we have a U.S. president say, well, let's just pull out of Europe. They don't need us anymore. You know, Russia's not our enemy, so let's just pull out.
Exactly. Well, I just find it interesting that 10 years after 9/11, 10 years after George Bush made that speech, Georgia and Ukraine are still not in NATO. You know?
Yeah.
But, all right, Jeff, listen, I'll let you go. I really appreciate you doing an interview with me. And, you know, especially we're talking about the Occupy Wall Street. That's a very hot topic right now. And I could see that in the future. I don't think it's going to go away now that the unions are backing them up. I think we're going to have a very interesting next year or so before the election.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
All right, Jeff, I'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
All right. Good thing. Thanks for having me.
Bye. Bye-bye. So, everyone, we're speaking to Jeff Nyquist. The website is jrnyquist.com and strategiccrisis.com.